Well, for several weeks we've been looking through the book of Daniel, and as we came to the conclusion of the chapters last week, I wanted to go back today and look at some major themes and ideas that we find in the book of Daniel. Daniel is one of the more popular books of the Old Testament. I would assume its popularity arises from a twofold. One is it has fascinating narratives. Has those stories that one can just enjoy listening to or hearing about. You have the three friends that are in the fiery furnace, and then you have Daniel in the lion's den. You have those type of stories that if one grew up going to church in Sunday school, then you heard about those in Sunday school, and yet they're not just for children. They continue. They're very fascinating stories. There's also the whole visions and prophecy aspect that brings in to it. So in that regard, Daniel is fairly unique in that it combines this prophetic aspect to it combined with narrative, and that makes Daniel a fairly unique book, and that's one of the reasons it's popular. Daniel also has, is one of those pivotal books in that at some level it demands you to think about how you're going to understand it. As it comes to the narrative, then that's narrative. You have history. You read it as you would other history. But when you come to the prophecy, one has to think about how do you understand prophecy. And prophecy becomes one of those big dividers of what theological camp you end up in, even in evangelical circles. So generally, broadly speaking, there are two approaches to prophecy. One approach is to say we take it as literally, factually as we can, as straightforward as you can. I mean, you recognize that there's figures of speech. You recognize that there's images, but you still see it as in that literal sense. The other one is to approach it and say, well, it's prophecies to be understood figuratively. The challenges with taking prophecy literally is understanding it all and making, putting things together, relating it. The challenge of understanding prophecy figuratively is, what does it mean? And if I understand it to be figuratively and mean this, and then somebody else understands it figuratively to mean this, and it's harder to find anything in that gives you a pattern, a meaning of how do you understand things. Once I was just not directed toward Daniel, but just recognizing my background and having gone to Dallas Seminary, and so shortly after graduating, I was like, okay, why? Why do I have the view I have toward the present, charismatic movement, which was still, wasn't super young at that time as getting started really in the 60s, and so this would be in the early 80s, but, realizing, okay, I went to Dallas Seminary, and that's really been my exposure, so I wanted to do some study on my own and come to, a little more of, what did I really think? But knowing my personality and so forth, knew I needed to have a book that was somewhat written from a little different angle than many of those the books are in that field. And so I looked for a book that found one that was published by InterVarsity Press. And the guy, in part in this book, had How to Interpret Dreams. And he had I don't remember exactly, but I'll just kind of make this up. He had 10 rules. And my immediate question was, where'd you get your rules? He has this self-appointed authority of these are the rules for interpreting dreams. And that, so not that that relates to prophecy, but it's the same general thing. When you say these are figures of speech, you run into the same problem. How do you determine what the figures of speech are? They're not literal, and that's one of the challenges you get into if you read people that approach prophecy from that perspective, is you're not going to find necessarily agreement in what it means, because it's just seen figuratively. Well, if you see it figuratively, generally speaking, there are two positions you fall into. Actually three. One is one is you see it as what's called postmillennialism, that Christ is going to return prior to the millennium, or all millennialism, that there is no millennial reign. Christ's return isn't connected to a millennium, because there is no earthly millennium. Or you see it, if you're see it as more literal or as literal, then you fall into a premillennial, and that Christ returns prior to the millennium. And the really the connection or the relationship there is that you're saying these things that it's speaking about really are going to happen. And so Daniel is very important from that standpoint. It's a book that shapes one's eschatology. It shapes the way you see the future, or I shouldn't say it shapes it. The way you approach it is going to shape that. That unless you have some reason that you're going to say, I'm not going to take it literally, Daniel is that book that's just startling, because Daniel was writing about things not just end times that are way out there for us, even that could be 1,000 years away or could be a few years away. It's still future. Daniel was writing about things that was future to him, but that's history to us, and we know it really happened. What Daniel said was going to happen, happened. And thus, those that come and approach Daniel, if you don't want to take it literally, you're forced from that position to say Daniel was written late. These events already occurred, and somebody wrote them down. Because if not, you're dealing with predictive history. Daniel said, Medo-Persia is going to be next. Greece will be next. I didn't actually list Rome, but the inferences in Rome fits it. And that's how things unfolded. So Daniel is a very powerful book. Daniel also is unique in that, as we looked at the three themes, and there's three themes that are developed, and these three themes are shown in pairs. And the three themes introduce us to the times of the Gentiles, a phrase that's used that we find in the book of, or in the Gospel of Luke. But the times of the Gentiles, which would be a description of what we live in. I mean, you could also say, well, we live in the church age, but we also live in the times of the Gentiles. That is, that Israel is not the agency, the country, or the nation, where God's people are, that God is ruling through. So we have, as we come through biblical history, with God calling Abraham, and then his descendants through Joseph ending up in Egypt, and a nation of people being formed in Egypt and being led out by Moses into the promised land. And as they go into the promised land, as Joshua takes them in, they become a nation. They not only have the people, but now they have a land. And this is where God reigns, and he reigns through them. And Israel is this prominent place. As the temple is built and so forth, God lives here. But then, as Daniel is a young boy, Israel goes into captivity. And it enters into this times of the Gentiles. God is still sovereign. Israel is still there, as we'll see. But the Gentiles, Gentile kings, Gentile rulers, are the ones ruling the earth, if you would, not a king of Israel. Well, these three pairs within this, they tell us a couple of things. One is that God has not abandoned Israel. Because all appearances would be, if you were at that time period, or even if we were reading back about that, would be God came to a point, he was fed up with Israel, and that was it. It's over. Daniel's telling us, no, God has not abandoned Israel. And secondly, God's plan for Israel continues. God's plan for Israel continues. Well, the first pair have to do with Gentile power in action. We see Gentile power, its authority, its dominance in action. However, it's presented to us with its definite limitations before God. And we see this in the pair of visions. The first was the one with Nebuchadnezzar with statues of metal. You recall that Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2 has a dream, and the dream bothers him. He's really, you know, bugged by this dream. It just is getting to him, and it appears to be a dream that he repeatedly has. And Nebuchadnezzar knows his wise men good enough that he says, you know, if I just tell them I've had a dream, I really, you know, this is my dream, I really need an answer to it, they're going to come up with some answer. They're going to do something to make Nebuchadnezzar happy. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, if you really have insight, you can tell me the dream and tell me the interpretation. Well, as the wise men said, nobody's ever asked that of anybody. That's not possible. This, you know, this, you're not playing fair here. And Nebuchadnezzar's, you know, basically says, hey, I'm the king, I don't have to play fair. If you don't tell me the dream, you're going to all lose your head. And so they're all headed to execution. When Daniel hears about it, which possibly Daniel would have been included in the group that's going to be executed, and Daniel says, let the king know I can give an answer. And he just needs some time to pray. Presumably he gets with his three friends. They pray. Daniel goes before the king, and he says, I don't have any answers. I don't have any insights. I don't understand dreams. But I happen to know the person, the God, that reveals dreams. And he tells him exactly what the dream was. And then he told him what the dream meant. And the dream was that he had was a large, very glorious man. But the man was made up of different metals. And so as each part, the head, the chest, the legs, represented different kingdoms. And Daniel said, here's Babylon. Next will come this other kingdom, another kingdom, another kingdom, and outlines this. And what it does is it gives an overall scope of Gentile history. This is what the near history will be. Here's the next four kingdoms that will come. That takes them over a span of, you know, several hundred years. And in that, it also starts pointing toward a millennial kingdom and the reign of Christ. Then in chapter 7, we come to the four beasts. And so Daniel has this dream that an angel comes and interprets, and it's of these four beasts. And the four beasts represent, you know, the same as Nebuchadnezzar's dream. You have these four kingdoms that are coming. And so we see this overall scope of Gentile history. Daniel presents from now, you know, to Rome, and then even into the millennium, what history will be, what nations will rule, and something about how that ruling will take place. And the details, you know, are exactly what happened in history. It unfolded exactly that way. Second pair of or a theme that's developed in a pair of chapters is God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty. In chapter 3, we have the fiery furnace. And if you would, just look at Daniel 3 for a moment. And there are three things that are developed here, are presented to us. One is that the three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are persecuted for being loyal to Yahweh. Or, more technically, they're persecuted for not bowing down and worshiping Nebuchadnezzar's image. You may recall Nebuchadnezzar comes up with this great idea, or is presented to him, say, we'll make this image, we'll take it through the town. When the music plays, everybody will fall down and worship. And lo and behold, everybody falls down, and these three Jewish gentlemen are standing. Young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and that's not acceptable. And so they are to be burnt alive. They're thrown into the fiery furnace, and they will be consumed in seconds. As a matter of fact, this is such an outrageous thing that let's heat this a little hotter. Let's get it hotter than we ever do. And it was so hot that the people that took them to throw them in, that the heat and the flames from the furnace actually consumed those throwing them into the furnace. But as Nebuchadnezzar could see into the furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego just continued to walk around, and it appeared that somebody was in there taking care of them. In this one, it shows us not only are they persecuted for being loyal to Yahweh, it shows us that men of God are faithful. Coming out of a period where Israel is in captivity because of their unfaithfulness, yet there's a remnant. The remnant may be small. The remnant may only be three, though we know that's true, not true that there's others. But even in this case, if they're the only remnant, there are at least three, a remnant, that continue to be faithful to Yahweh. Daniel's not on the scene in this chapter. We do not know where he is. We assume that Daniel was not present because he would have been pointed out also, unless those... they chose just not to include Daniel because of political reasons and said, let's go after these three, let's leave Daniel alone. But it seems more likely that maybe Daniel was out of town on king's business. And in this, what primarily we see is that God is sovereign over king's power. God is sovereign over king's power. Well, in this account, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, their perspective of God and God's sovereignty comes out very strong. The king tells them, this is what we're going to do. We're going to play this music again, and you will bow down and worship. And their response is, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. You know, one thing about Nebuchadnezzar, and it continued to grow, but as you probably could assume about any king, but very clearly about Nebuchadnezzar, is ego was not in check. And when you tell him, oh, we have a God, and he can deliver us out of your hand, that had to infuriate him. That's probably when the furnace got turned up a couple of notches. Just how dare you think that anybody's above me? And they just say, hey, he's able. He will. But then the real faith issue. I mean, it would be a definite faith issue for these three guys if the night before, God had said, okay, tomorrow they're going to play this music, and this is what I want you to do. I want you to stand fast. I will not let any harm come to you. If they had that promise, it would take a lot of faith to still follow through with that. But they didn't have that kind of promise. They only had theology. They had theology. They had a belief in God. They knew who their God was. They knew what he was capable of. And they say, the first part is, this is what God is capable of doing. He is able to deliver us. And then they follow it and they say, but even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. See, what they end up saying is, God is able. We have absolute confidence our God is above you. Therefore, we're not going to worship you or your images, because we have a superior God. He is able to deliver us, but even if he chooses not to deliver us, he still is greater. Therefore, we will not worship. Well, Nebuchadnezzar, as it says in the next verse, was filled with wrath, and his facial expressions were altered. And he gave orders to heat the furnace seven times more than it's usually heated. I don't know how hot furnaces are, but if furnaces normally burn at 1,000 degrees, now it's burning at 7,000. If coals are generally at 2,000 degrees, now we're talking 14,000 degrees. I don't think they had a thermometer, so I don't know that we're talking literally somebody knew it was seven times, but in the way you approximate it, or the amount of fuel you put in there to cause this to happen, this was an intense heat, and it backfired. Backfired in for those that carried through the orders, because they were consumed, and it did not accomplish its purposes that Nebuchadnezzar had. However, the purposes of God were clearly there, as Nebuchadnezzar, is so positive that no one can deliver you. He, prior to asking them their final question, Nebuchadnezzar said, "What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Obviously, he's not asking a question expecting an answer. Surely that's rhetorical for him, meaning he's saying, there is no God great enough to deliver out of my hands. Because Nebuchadnezzar basically would see himself in that role. Well, after they're delivered from the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, insomuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." That's a pretty fast change. I don't know what the timetable is here, but I would imagine we're at most talking hours and perhaps talking minutes from when he says, there is no God that can deliver, to saying, there is no God like their God. There's no God like their God. I don't know, people are very upset today in the Western world about the Christianity because of its exclusiveness. Just the very thought that Jesus is the only way to heaven is just an affront to the way people think. It's just not, you cannot have those kind of standards in our nation. And can you imagine what they'd do with Nebuchadnezzar's statements? Here's the king, and he makes a decree that if you speak ill of Yahweh, you're going to be torn from limb to limb. That's a pretty radical change for Nebuchadnezzar. He learned in a hurry that God is sovereign. Yahweh is sovereign. And see why that's so important is Nebuchadnezzar is the first Gentile king to rule over Israel. And he quickly learns that while he is the human ruling over Israel, that their God rules over him. Well, the other pair that goes with this is the lion's den in chapter 6. Daniel suffers a similar fate later. This is not during Nebuchadnezzar's reign, but during the early reign of Cyrus, the king of Media Persia. And Daniel has been appointed one of the top three vice presidents of the nation. And he is now being considered to be put in charge over everything under the king. And at least the two people that were his co-regency aren't happy. And a whole bunch of other people aren't happy. And they decide they want to get rid of Daniel. But there's nothing they can do. There's There's no violations. Daniel doesn't have anything in his life that allows you to go attack him. And so they finally decided the only thing, the only weakness he can have is with his religion. If we could come up with something related to his devotion to his God. And so they come up, they approach the king and say, all of your top officials, which would include Daniel, are in agreement this is what you should do. But it didn't include Daniel. Daniel wasn't consulted. Daniel wasn't in agreement. But that's what they told the king. And they came up with something similar to what Nebuchadnezzar did. Is this is, you know, this is how you worship. So you shouldn't worship anybody else, is their plan. Do not worship any other gods except the king. Well, Daniel continues in his same thing. They, you know, if it had been today, they got a video camera or they got their cell phone with their camera on it, and they video him doing his normal thing, going to his window, facing Jerusalem, and praying. And one of the things with the Media Persia is they had a rule. Seems to be their one big rule is that when a king makes a rule, when he makes a law, that law is law. You don't just change it. And the king had no way out. The king realized he had been tricked. But that's the law. Daniel's to be fed to the lions. The king even indicates that Daniel, you got a really good God there. Maybe he'll take care of you. He's very hopeful. There's very little that he can do about it. The king says to Daniel, says, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. What a powerful statement from this king. He recognized something about Daniel, which is evidently why Daniel's in the position he's in. But he was, nevertheless, they made this very ill-advised law to everybody had to pray only to him. And Daniel's left in the lion's den. Well, the lions that appear to just give Daniel a nice, soft, warm evening and cuddle up there with the lions. And then the king comes and he checks on Daniel. And he says, Daniel, servant of the living God. Servant of the living God. And he gives Yahweh a pretty high title, servant of the living God. This is in chapter 6 and verse 20. Has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel speaks, O king, live forever. The king was pleased, gave orders for Daniel to be taken up. And then the king gave orders for all those that came up with this plan to be thrown into the lion's den. And the lions ate them immediately, showing that the lions, showing that the lions really weren't just, hadn't gone become vegetarians or anything. And then Cyprus, or Darius, Cyprus, probably the same person, but he makes this statement. He wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of language who were living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the domain of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues, performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so we have two different kings, two different setting, but very similar, and they're paired together. Chapter 3, chapter 6. You have God, Yahweh, is able to deliver. in both situations. Nebuchadnezzar said he couldn't do it. Cyprus is not denying that he can do it. They both affirm at the end, this God, the God of Daniel, he's a God that delivers. He's a God that delivers. Well, the third theme that we find in Daniel, it's also presented in a pair of chapters, is God's sovereign judgment. God's sovereign judgment. In chapter 4, we have the tree vision where Nebuchadnezzar has a vision, and once again, it takes Daniel to interpret this vision. But basically what Nebuchadnezzar is that Nebuchadnezzar is just full of himself. I mean, he's already made acknowledgments about Yahweh in terms of that it's Daniel or Daniel's God and so forth. But Nebuchadnezzar just continues to soar in his prosperity. He is a powerful king. And one day he's walking around in his gardens and he's overlooking his kingdom and all the things he's had constructed. And he says, man, I am so good. Look how great I am. Look at all of this. Look at all I've accomplished. And at that moment, his dream started taking place. And what happened is Nebuchadnezzar went crazy. He's just nuts for 7 years. He's actually put out in a pasture. He goes out and acts like a cow. He eats grass. He lives like a beast. Incredible provision by God, because anywhere in history, you know, if you could find something like that, you know this king would be put out of his misery immediately so somebody else could assume the throne. It would happen so quickly. I mean, kings that are powerful are assassinated. What would happen to a weak king like this? But Nebuchadnezzar is protected by God. And he goes through the spirit of judgment. And then he comes to his senses. And at the end of chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, verse 33, it says, immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird claws. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? At that time, my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom, and my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. Now that's somebody that's speaking from experience. Nebuchadnezzar. Well, the corresponding chapter that's paired up with this for judgment is the next chapter, chapter 5. And this is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar at the end of the Babylonian rule. Belshazzar is king, and he, perhaps his predecessor somewhere along Daniel, has been off the scene. Belshazzar doesn't seem to even know of Daniel. And they're celebrating. Media Persia is outside the walls, wanting to come in and take over the kingdom, but they're in a walled city, and they are perfectly confident that they will survive. And so, in part, they have a big party, And it's a way of just saying to his people, his army, that, hey, we're confident, we're in charge here, nothing's going to happen. We've got all the provisions in here to outlast them. They will have to go home. We're safe. We're intact. And then in the middle of all this celebration, which included that he sent for the goblets that came from the temple in Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar brought back, he said, go get the goblets and let's toast to the gods of gold, the gods of silver. And if we're going to toast to the gods of gold, let's drink out of golden goblets. And at that moment, this hand appears. Not an arm, just a hand. A writing instrument. It writes on the wall. It perhaps the font is difficult to read and you couldn't read it. That's a possibility. It seems to me that they most likely could read the words, just nobody knew what the words meant. I mean, I know what the word says, but it doesn't make sense when you put these words together. And finally, the Queen Mother comes up with the idea of, you know, there's Daniel. Daniel was, he in Nebuchadnezzar's day, he could interpret. And so they get Daniel, and Daniel says, well, what it says is that this is the last night. Judgment is upon you. And that night, that was the final night for Babylon. History tells us that they shut off the water to the city and came in through the river, underground river that came into the city. The city wasn't as secure as they thought, and Medo-Persia ruled. The thing that we see here is that in both of these, only the man of God can interpret the visions. Nobody else can interpret them. Only the man of God. And God sets up kings and kingdoms. God can take down kings. God can set up kings. Once again, all of this is that God is sovereign over Israel. And those that rule over Israel do so under God's plan. And those three themes, at least those three themes, are presented in Daniel and they're presented in pairs. It's a very interesting structure. If you look at chapter 2 and chapter 7, they go together. They both speak of a Gentile power in action. You have the statue of metals and the four beasts. Then if you look at God's sovereignty, you have in chapter 3 and in chapter 6, persecution, the fiery furnace and the lion's den. And both of these are showing us that God is sovereign over king's power. And then right in the middle, chapters 4 and 5, you have judgment. The judgment that came upon Nebuchadnezzar personally, the judgment that came upon Babylon. And Daniel is outlined in those early narrative passages that way. Major usages of Daniel in the New Testament. There are two things that we see that go in the New Testament that are very powerful. Is one is the use of the term the Son of Man. This was Jesus' preferred term. I remember when I first became a Christian being hearing in around some writings that you had Son of God. This was a title of Jesus' deity. And Son of Man, this was the title of his humanity, and you had this, and that cannot be right. Son of Man just almost certainly comes from a passage in Daniel. In Daniel chapter 7 and verse 13, Daniel, in the vision, it makes a reference. It says, and I kept looking at in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancients of Days and was presented before him. We have a messianic picture here. Well, when Jesus showed up on the scene, they were looking for the Messiah. But the term Messiah and all the things with Messiah had been kind of filtered through their mindset. And their mindset was the Messiah would be a political deliverer from Rome. The Messiah will lead us into a kingdom, you know, his kingdom, but it's a political kingdom. It's an earthly political kingdom, and it'll be a defeater of Rome. So the Messiah, it's, you know, when you, if you, if you were to say at that time period and you start talking about the Messiah, here's all the, you know, the filters of this is what the Messiah is. So Jesus came up with a very obscure reference to the Messiah. And his choice reference to himself was the Son of Man. I don't believe it was anything about his humanity. It was a messianic title. He was claiming to be Messiah, but he was doing so in saying, I'm not the Messiah you're expecting. I'm the Messiah that God has promised. In the Gospels, the Son of Man is used 84 times. And most of these, I didn't go through them, but the vast majority of these will be statements where Jesus is talking about being the Son of Man. Compare that to the Son of God is used 27 times, and those are references that almost always that others are making, either derogatorily or positively about Jesus. Also, abomination of desolation. In Daniel 11:31 and 12:11, the phrase abomination of desolation is used, and then Jesus picks up that phrase recorded in Matthew 24 and also in Mark 13 about when the abomination of desolation occurs, a period in the tribulation that's yet to come. And so the abomination of desolation, we saw within Daniel and in looking at history that this would be a Tychonese Epiphanes that fulfilled this in a historical, from us, a historical role when he desecrated the temple in about 165 B.C. but then also will, as he was a type of the Antichrist, that the Antichrist will do the similar thing in the middle of the tribulation period. And so those become two major usages in the New Testament. There's also insights and confirmations that we find, and there are at least three of them. One is God answers prayer. God answers prayer. In Daniel 9:23, Daniel has been praying. Daniel is aware that the 70 years is about up. And Daniel has been praying about that. And an angel comes and is responding. And in part, he says, at the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I have come to tell you, you are highly esteemed. At the beginning of your supplications, Daniel's got a fairly lengthy, you know, for scripture, a fairly lengthy prayer. And you can imagine what you would be thinking if you were Daniel. Okay, I read over here that this captivity is about 70 years, and as I've been kind of calculating, we're almost at the end of that 70 years. And Daniel says, you know, I need to pray about this. And, you know, somebody ought to confess that the nation really was wrong. Somebody ought to apologize to God. And Daniel says, I'll do that. So Daniel begins this. And can you imagine taking that task on? That somehow you have to confess the sins of others, put yourself as a part of the nation and make a confession for all the nation, for all the things they've done, to allow God to end this judgment. You got to convince God, in other words, from your perspective, I got to convince God to cease this judgment and restore us. And you're trying to figure out, how do I phrase this? How do I pray? What words do I use? Have you ever been in that situation where you want to pray, but you're saying, okay, how do I say this? I want to say this right. How do I say it? And the angel comes and says, at the beginning of your supplication. You know when you said, dear Father, that's when I sent the answer. Isn't that incredible? At the beginning, not at the end, not when you said that magic word. It's that third sentence in the 15th paragraph that got me. And I said, okay, angel, go give Daniel the answer. No, at the beginning. And then the same thing we read in chapter 12 and verse 11. Daniel had prayed, and now it's some time after his prayer. So I gave you the wrong verse there. Let me see where I'm at. 10:12, chapter 10, verse 12. And Daniel has prayed, but it's been a while. And he said, the angel comes and says, "Do not be afraid, Daniel. For from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before God, your words were heard." From the first day that you said, "I really want to understand this." From the first day you said, "I want to be in a humble position," or basically didn't say it, but you know, humbled himself before God. God said, "Hey, here's the answer." Now, it turned out that the answer didn't come for a while because there's also the second point here. There's spiritual warfare. There's spiritual warfare. And in the verse below this, in verse 13, it says, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. God sent the angel to tell Daniel the answer. But the angel couldn't get there for 21 days because of angelic conflict. We read of this in other passages in the Bible. Paul says we struggle, you know, our real war, our, you know, the real war that we face is spiritual. It's the intangible. It's behind the scene. It's between the powers. It's a spiritual warfare. And therefore, Paul says, put on the spiritual armor. Now, for you and I, what we see is a struggle against the flesh. I mean, we see the struggle against various specific temptations, or whether it's an economy that's falling apart, or whether it's a society that's going in a different direction than we think it ought to go, or whether it's health issues, whether it's children that aren't behaving the way that you need them to behave as parents, if it's relational issue, whatever those real issues, I mean real tangible issues, concrete issues we deal with in life that are real, that you don't dismiss. And Paul talks about them. Paul's not saying they're not real, but he's saying the real battle is behind that. There's a spiritual. So it's not ignore what's concrete, but understand that often what's concrete, behind it is a spiritual battle. The third of the insights and confirmation is the resurrection. The resurrection. Daniel is one of the few books in the Old Testament that speaks about the resurrection. In Daniel chapter 12 and verse 2, it says, "Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt." That there's a resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous, believers and unbelievers, Daniel speaks. Later in this same chapter, at the very end, verse 13, the angel tells Daniel, "But as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age." Daniel's being told, Daniel, you're not going to see everything fulfilled in this book. You'll die first. Go to your rest. See, death it can be used in that figure of speech, you know, that kind of a nice way to speak about something that's harsh, by saying rest. If there is a resurrection, it's a rest because there's a resurrection. Go. Live your life. One day you will die. You will rest. But you will be resurrected. So Daniel ends with that hope of all hopes, a future resurrection. From Daniel, it is promised that's not based upon something historic. From our perspective, Christ was the first reap. Christ was resurrected. And we have that promise as it goes forth. So Daniel is a powerful book, a book that in part continues to tell us, even though maybe we weren't asking that question the same way Daniel was, but in this time of the Gentiles, what about Israel? Well, there's an overall scope. It's going along to God's plan. God is sovereign. God is sovereign. See, and that's so important because in this time period, a nation's God was viewed as being as powerful as that nation was. If the nation was defeated, that God was defeated. How else could you account for it? Here is Israel's defeated, but God is still sovereign. Yahweh is still sovereign. And Yahweh is sovereign in judgment. He sets up kings and kingdoms. It's not by accident that Babylon was in charge, and it's not by accident that Babylon went out and Medo-Persian came in. God has a plan. He sets up kings. And then it also gives us affirmations that God answers prayer, that there's spiritual warfare, and that there is a resurrection. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank you so much for this book of Daniel and just our opportunity to be exposed to it. It clearly is a book that has many mysteries to it, things that perhaps are beyond our spiritual maturity, perhaps beyond our the time that we live in. But there are many things that are clear. There are many statements and many facts and many presentations that are very clear in this book. And we thank you for that. We thank you for a man such as Daniel that was so faithful, that even in his life, in his devotion to you, that he gives us a model to follow. And Father, we pray that you would use this book, use these truths in our lives to build us up in Christ and to always give us that hope of that in the midst of this time, a time that earthly kings rule the earth, not a king of your appointed nation, that you're still sovereign and things are still going according to your plan, and you will work out your plan. And we pray in Christ's name. Amen.